is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Tuesday, December 3rd. Friday was Black Friday. Yesterday was Cyber Monday. Today in the nonprofit world is Giving Tuesday, but it's also Pass the Baton Day, as Democrats and Republicans from the Intelligence Committee are handing their reports from their impeachment hearings to the House Judiciary Committee, which begins its hearings tomorrow. Remember, the Judiciary Committee has to take it now because that's the committee that writes actual articles of impeachment. And Judiciary has now released the names of the four impeachment scholars who will testify tomorrow. So let's see what's coming in the committee-to-committee handoff and what to expect tomorrow and beyond. With me now is New York Times congressional correspondent Nicholas Fandos. Hi, Nicholas. Thanks so much for coming on.
Hey, thank you, Brian.
So you wrote last night that the Adam Schiff Democrats report from the Intelligence Committee was shrouded in mystery. What were some of the mysteries, and are they cleared up yet as of now?
They are not cleared up. I think what the report will say is actually the least mysterious thing about it. After several weeks of public testimony, after I think a dozen and a half witness deposition transcripts were released, I think we know the sum and substance of the story that Democrats are going to tell. But what we don't know is exactly what form that story will take. We don't know if there will be new supplemental details in it that bolster the case or undercut the Democratic case. And most importantly, I think, for the way this process is moving forward, we don't know whether the committee will explicitly recommend impeachment or enumerate articles of impeachment that it thinks the Judiciary Committee ought to consider, or whether it will simply say, here are the facts, we believe they're serious, and you, Judiciary Committee, you decide what to do with them.
The Republican report is out, and it says the president's actions were okay. Now, Nicholas, I might have expected them to say, yeah, bad, but not bad enough for impeachment. But how much further than that did they go in defending or excusing the president's behavior? He says, perfect phone call.
Yeah, this is not the kind of defense that we have seen in presidential impeachments in the past, and perhaps it reflects the politics of the moment in that regard. But essentially, Republicans over 120 or so pages, not only absolve the president of impeachable offenses, but brook him no wrongdoing. They find no instances of misbehavior or anything untoward. In fact, they argue that his interest in investigating the Bidens in their work in Ukraine, his interest in investigating possible collusion between the Democrats and the Ukrainians in 2016, both of those things were perfectly legitimate. They argue that his skepticism of Ukraine was deep-seated and well-founded, and that he withheld military aid and a White House meeting purely for altruistic and non-political reasons. And ultimately, he granted those things when he became satisfied that the new Ukrainian government was indeed legitimate and was fighting corruption. So it's an across-the-board absolution of the president, and obviously what we're going to hear from the Democrats later today is going to be completely at odds with that.
And you wrote, as a matter of journalism, that the Republicans' conclusion about Trump's behavior is at odds with sworn testimony from senior American diplomats and White House officials that we heard in the Intelligence Committee hearings. What's a core example or two of that?
That's right. Well, I mean, as you recall, in the testimony we heard, several officials with, different perches in the government describing how it became clear to them that President Trump was withholding certainly a White House meeting and was likely withholding this military aid in order to try and have leverage over the Ukrainians to get these investigations that he wanted, and that there was a kind of broad campaign that employed both his personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, outside of the government, and officials inside the government to make that happen. And so while we heard that testimony, the Republican report basically disaggregates each of those points and offers an alternate explanation and says basically that what you have from these witnesses, their sworn testimony, they may believe to be true, but it's merely speculation or a belief on their part, and therefore should not be taken at face value. I mean, they really go after some of these witnesses as, quote-unquote, unelected bureaucrats who are dissatisfied with the president's policies and therefore are, trying to tell on him.
But let me just follow up on one what I consider central piece of evidence, even if it's evidence by omission, and ask you if the Republican report addresses it at all. Trump never asked Ukraine about any systemic corruption or any individual piece of alleged corruption other than asking that they investigate the Bidens. Do they even try to make a case that Trump showed any evidence of caring about corruption generally in Ukraine?
They certainly make this point as a declarative statement in their executive summary and their conclusions and throughout the report, that what the president was really interested in was rooting out corruption writ large in Ukraine, and that his actions were motivated by that. But they don't have any evidence to point to, and they don't, in discussing the call record, you know, specifically the word corruption or general discussion of corruption never came up between Trump and Zelensky at that point or others. So it kind of takes the form of an assertion or a matter of fact that the Republicans present, but they don't have any evidence in particular to back that up.
So after 2 months in the Intelligence Committee, on we go tomorrow to the House Judiciary Committee, which actually writes articles of impeachment. Nicholas, you write that it's likely to be a messy public spectacle suffused with partisan rancor. That actually sounds very familiar. So do you expect that to be of a different nature than what we saw in the Intelligence Committee?
I think it's going to be on steroids, essentially. And part of the reason is just the way these committees are constituted and the rules under which they operate. The Intelligence Committee is a very small, hand-picked panel where the House Speaker and the Republican leader get to pick their members, and they often do it based on their, you know, bona fides for national security and their ability to work seriously across the aisle. It's a very small panel, about half the size of the Judiciary Committee. And basically, because they're dealing with sensitive government secrets, the chairman, Adam Schiff, has an incredible amount of power and control over what happens in the committee. It's the rules allow him to kind of keep a tight grasp on those things. Well, the Judiciary Committee, where we're going next, is, you know, almost the polar opposite. It's a committee that is constituted to debate not just big constitutional questions like impeachment, but some of the most divisive policy issues before the Congress. Abortion rights, gun rights, immigration law, voting rights, the list goes on and on. Things that have become or have tended to be either kind of culture war battles or just big policy disputes between the two parties. And so it's a panel that attracts some of the most outspoken progressives and conservatives in both parties, and, you know, gives a lot of leeway for debate and for back and forth. And that process can look messy. It can be loud, and it tends to devolve into a lot of speechifying.
And I guess this suggests the length of the hearing that we're likely to see tomorrow, if the Judiciary Committee includes twice the number of members of the Intelligence Committee, and each member gets a 5-minute shot at these witnesses. Is that how it's going to work?
Absolutely. And remember, the Judiciary Committee is going to be operating under the same special rules that we saw the Intelligence Committee operating under in terms of witness questioning. So at the outset of the hearing, the chairman and the top Republican may designate a staff lawyer to question the witnesses for up to 45 minutes. So I suspect we'll see those extended blocks of questioning at the beginning, and then it's going to take hours for each of the Republicans and each of the Democrats to take their 5 minutes at questioning. So I think we're in for a long day.
Tomorrow's hearing is not for fact witnesses. It's for four scholars of impeachment, and they've now released the names. They are all law school professors: Noah Feldman from Harvard, Pamela Carlin from Stanford, Michael Gerhardt from UNC, University of North Carolina, and Jonathan Turley from George Washington University. Now, under the usual House rules, the majority party gets to invite three witnesses and the minority party one witness. The one witness who the Republicans called is Jonathan Turley from George Washington University. Is it clear to you why they selected him?
Yeah, it is. So Turley has been out speaking in recent weeks about the impeachment inquiry. And he's somebody who has historically presented himself as open-minded to both parties. And I think this is why the Republicans are interested, because what he basically contends is that a serious investigation ought to be done into the Ukraine matter and that the facts that have come forward are unflattering, but that Democrats are rushing the process and that they don't have their case nailed down, and that proceeding with impeachment now could dramatically lower the standard of proof and the kind of nature of the process as it has been, you know, used so rarely in American history. And so I think what Republicans are trying to do is bring somebody in that will have some credence with independent-minded voters, perhaps with some Democrats, and be able to make a more persuasive case than if, say, they brought in a kind of more orthodox pro-Trump constitutional expert who, you know, may echo their own talking points about how, you know, the president did nothing wrong.
Turley's concern about rushing the process actually intersects with something that I think is a very interesting question and gets discussed a little bit in the media, but not all that much. And that is, why wouldn't the Democrats, facing likely defeat at the end of the process, not likely to get 20 Republican senators to flip and actually remove the president from office? I know it's possible, but it seems very unlikely as of now. Why wouldn't the Democrats slow it down, as Turley says they should, and push for the subpoenas on Trump officials to be upheld in court? Some of them presumably would be upheld, and just create a robust factual record, more than they have now, on Ukraine, on obstruction of justice in the Russia investigation, maybe even more things, that is sure to be damning in an election year.
I think it's a really important question, and I can give a best stab at an answer for what the Democrats are thinking. But to be honest with you, they have not been completely forthcoming about the rationale for their timeline and what their considerations they're making beyond these. So a couple of them are, you know, we heard Chairman Schiff last night on television say, you know, there's a point in an investigation where you recognize that it would be quite some time until you got the next tranche of significant evidence for one reason or another. And when you reach that point, you have to decide, is it worth continuing to go forward or is it worth pulling up and moving the process along in another way? They seem to be making that decision. So here's what I think they have in mind. A number of the additional witnesses that they could get who could potentially provide meaningful testimony have indicated that they won't do so without a court order, as your listeners know. You know, that's a process that even on an expedited basis would take several months. I'm not a constitutional expert, but expert in the judicial system, but those who are suggest to me, I mean, we're talking 4, 6, maybe more months. And these are complex issues to litigate that have several layers to them. So I think what Democrats are most fearful of is that this whole process will get bogged down and to such an extent that we would be, you know, on that kind of time horizon, you'd be looking at late spring or early summer with an election just a few months away, not to mention the risks with President Trump of the news cycle just totally getting wrestled away and the public losing interest in the case. I think they basically feel they have strong enough evidence and an obligation to move forward with urgency. The last explanation I'll offer, which is another one we keep hearing from Democrats, and you can evaluate it as you wish, is that they feel that the behavior, the misconduct that they see that they've uncovered is so alarming and directly affects the coming election, because the president appears to have been soliciting assistance in that election, that it warrants speedy action or a speedy attempt to have him removed from office, because they think it's a direct threat to the election. You know, I think those answers will be dissatisfying or unsatisfying to some people, but that's the explanation we've been given by the Democrats, and which, you know, most of their members at this point seem to be satisfied with.
So that's some analysis of the Democrats' political game plan from this point. You wrote that the Republicans' goal is to confuse the public with such a mishmash of information, your words, a mishmash of information and competing claims, I guess we could say, that even Republicans troubled by Trump's behavior see no upside in breaking with him. So give us a viewer's and listener's guide about how that's supposed to work.
So I think what we're going to see from Republicans going forward is, for one, a continuation of what we've seen so far, which is a kind of defense of the behavior itself, these kind of explanations for what Trump was doing that are innocent rather than nefarious. That includes, you know, portraying his interest in the specific investigations he was asking for as legitimate rather than political, and so on and so forth, as I discussed earlier. But I think what we'll also see uniquely in the Judiciary Committee is all kinds of parliamentary hijinks that will, you know, try and make the Democrats look as if they are rushing this through, as if they are being unfair, really undercut what the Democrats want, which is a clear-cut, straightforward, urgent case. And I think they feel that if there is a reasonable doubt that the case is those things, then they'll be able to hold together the president's base in terms of voters and Republicans in the House. And if they can stave off any Republicans voting for articles of impeachment on the House floor, and the case arrives in the Senate as a purely having been purely supported by the Democrats, that will cast a kind of mood over the Senate trial that is much more likely, or is going to make it much harder for Republicans to break ranks there, and, you know, therefore lead to a better outcome for the president and for his party.
We have a few minutes left. Let me touch a couple of other things real quick. President Zelensky also went public in an interview yesterday and did not want to talk about bribes or extortion or quid pro quos the way we talk about it here, but he did say the U.S. shouldn't withhold aid. I'm curious if, to your eye, if you got into this, Zelensky's interview gives ammunition to either side in the next round of hearings.
Well, I mean, we saw yesterday both sides pulling pieces out of it, and the president, I believe, misquoting what President Zelensky had said. You know, it's been hard throughout for us as journalists to evaluate some of what the Ukrainian leaders are now saying publicly in the context of this impeachment inquiry, because, frankly, they're still under a tremendous amount of pressure. President Trump is still in office, and they don't want to further alienate him because they do need this assistance. And so, you have to question the motivations around everything that they have to say. I think what the message Zelensky was trying to send was, you know, we don't want to be, you know, as we've heard witnesses say, they advised him months and months ago not to get into United States politics. We don't want to be wrapped up in your politics, but this support, which has been bipartisan in the past, you know, for this military conflict that we have in our country, that's vital. It's in your interest, and the worst thing that could happen is for that to be a casualty of this whole process. So I suspect we may hear Democrats more than Republicans, but perhaps both sides pulling from that.
And last thing, timeline. You report that the House has now announced it will stay in session until December 20th. That's the Friday before Christmas. And it's a week later than originally planned before Christmas break. What does that tell you about what we're likely to see and when during this month?
So it is still our expectation that the Democrats would like to vote on articles of impeachment on the House floor before Christmas. So that means that we have basically the next 2.5 weeks for this process to play out. Adding that additional week, I think, makes it possible, though it's certainly going to be fast. Beginning today with the transmission to the Judiciary Committee and tomorrow's hearing, I think we'll see one or potentially two more hearings from the Judiciary Committee early next week, and then they'll begin to likely draft, debate, and vote on articles of impeachment at the committee level. And the vote that they take is basically ultimately whether or not to recommend the full House vote on those articles of impeachment. And if they vote in the affirmative to make that recommendation, we could see the House in the final days before Christmas, the same calendar day on which they impeached President Bill Clinton a couple of decades ago. Voting on this and then jetting out of town. The one caveat I will add is that there's also a government funding deadline coming up on December 20th, so they also have to figure out how to keep the government open and not repeat last year's Christmas time government shutdown. So it's certainly going to be a complicated, busy, and fraught time on Capitol Hill for this holiday season.
Nicholas Van Dose, congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Some of you know that we've been inviting listeners to Impeachment, a daily podcast, to write and record one article of impeachment of your own. What language would you use to charge Trump under the Constitution? And this is last call. We'll close this out on Thursday and turn the page and invite Trump defenders to call in our next round and say why not to impeach. But here is an article of impeachment from one of you.
The president violated his duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed in violation of Article 2, Section 3, Clause 5 of the United States Constitution by taking too many vacation days, spending too much time on Twitter and watching TV instead of doing his job, by lying voluminously, and by causing substantial harm to the international reputation of the United States.
Thank you for taking the time to write and record that from the Bay Area of California. And now, as the Judiciary Committee moves toward their articles of impeachment, this is last call for yours. They can be about Ukraine or not. And next week, we'll invite Trump supporters to write for the defense. Our article of impeachment voicemail is 844-745-TALK, 844-745-8255, 844-745-TALK. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.